Welcome to the Grace Truth Podcast, where we explore questions related to faith, sexuality, and gender. This podcast is sponsored by the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender. To find out more about the center, please visit us at centerforfaith.com. Welcome to episode one of the Grace Truth Podcast. I'm Preston Sprinkle, and I serve as the president of the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender. And I'm joined with my special guest and good friend, Greg Coles. Greg, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Greg is the author of a recently released book called Single Gay Christian. He's also a PhD student at Penn State, where he's studying English and rhetoric, linguistics, I mean, all things related to how language works, which makes him a perfect candidate to help us think through our current topic, which is the importance of language in the LGBT plus conversation. And if you're joining us from the book study, from the Grace Truth book, this episode corresponds to conversation one, where we talk about language. Now, much of what we're going to talk about assumes that you've read that conversation one in that book. But for those who haven't read conversation one in the Grace Truth book, Greg, why don't you get us all on equal footing by giving us a general introduction to how language works and why language is so important in the LGBT plus conversation?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I won't presume to give us in, 5 minutes or fewer exactly all of how language works. And there are a few competing theories, but I'll try to frame a bit of how I study language and how I think we can understand the importance of language in this conversation.
Okay.
The guy that I study in graduate school, his name is Kenneth Burke. And he's got this theory where he describes language as being like color lenses that you can put into a camera when you take pictures of the world. And so he says, when you choose a term, it's like choosing a color lens to put in to your camera, and that lens will always draw attention to certain parts of reality and simultaneously deflect attention away from other parts of reality. So you choose a word and you pick, here are the things I want to draw attention to. Here are the things I want to draw attention away from. And we as speakers make those choices, whether consciously or subconsciously. And then the people who listen to us try to interpret our words and determine based on what we've said, how we perceive the world, what we think is important or unimportant about the world.
So basically, I mean, to summarize that, if I could do it in one line, is language is way more complex than the average person realizes. Would that be a fair kind of 30,000 foot description?
That's what I want you to believe so that I can finish my PhD for sure. but yes, there's a lot going on when we use words. It's not as simple as this word always means the same thing to all people in all contexts, and we just need to find the right word, period, no questions asked. But language is going to be complicated because it's an interaction between people who are also complicated.
Right. So a Jewish friend of mine, he grew up in New York, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism in his upbringing, and he said, you know what, growing up, if somebody asked me, are you Jewish? That was a perfectly fine question. But if somebody said, are you a Jew? Even though linguistically that kind of basically means the same thing, there was just something about that second phrase, are you a Jew, that carried with it this kind of simmering anti-Semitism just beneath the surface of the question. And it almost felt like an accusation more than a question. Now, grammatically, those two phrases are almost identical, but given how they've been used and the cultural context, they sent off different sort of meanings or signals from each other. Would that be, I mean, that was just kind of an example I've heard, but I mean, is that, as a linguist, does that kind of make sense? Like, oh yeah, that's exactly how language can be very complicated.
Yeah. I think that example illustrates really well the fact that what seemed to speakers like really small nuances in language can carry a lot of meaning in them. And of course, language is also going to determine the possibilities for what we're capable of categorizing the world into. So let me give you kind of a silly example and then a slightly more serious example of what I mean by that. Growing up, I grew up in Indonesia. And in Indonesia, because most native-born Indonesians have black hair, there are not really a lot of people around with other colors than black hair. And so they have a single word. The word pirang means both red hair and blonde hair. We've just got one word because there's not a lot of red-haired or blonde-haired people, so we just kind of clump them all together. And so pirang was kind of the category that I had for a certain kind of hair. And when I moved to America and started meeting people who had blonde hair and red hair and trying to differentiate them, people would be like, oh, what color hair does she have? And I would be like, I think it's blonde. And people would see her later and be like, she's like a flaming redhead. How can you not tell that? And I would be like, I don't know. It just looks pirang to me.
Which is a
silly example. And arguably there's a lot of reasons to explain why that happened. But one thing that linguists will often say is that when we have words that help us think in certain categories, it often becomes difficult for us to think outside of those categories. So we tend to veer into the categories that we have language
so,
for.
So that growing up with that certain word, ended up almost shaping the way you view the world. Like you didn't see, even though we'd be looking at a blonde girl and a redhead girl, like we're looking at the same colors and everything because of the way the linguistic environment you grew up in, it actually shapes how you're processing things in the world. Would that be accurate? That's really
fascinating. So there are Native American languages that have different words for dark green and light green. And linguists who studied them found that they would look at something dark green and something light green and say, oh, two very different colors. And then when an English speaker looked at them, they would say, oh, yeah, it's green, it's green, it's all green. So quite literally, language does shape our perception. So when Burke calls language like a camera lens, that's not just kind of an abstract metaphor, but it really can be as visual, as concrete as the colors that we see. Or as the way that we interpret the world. And of course, that can get really insidious too when you think about something like the phrase collateral damage.
Right.
Which was popularized by the US military to describe civilian casualties. But we didn't like calling them civilian casualties because it made us sound bad. And so instead, we coined the term collateral damage. Or before collateral damage, I think in the Vietnam War, they called civilian casualties regrettable byproducts of war. And so with this language, we could assume that those things were just kind of inevitabilities, not something for which the United States needed to bear any kind of ethical responsibility. Right. But so that shift in language enabled a kind of shift in ethical perception.
Even the phrase civilian casualties, I mean, when I think of going on a casual walk,
killing innocent
walk,
people just doesn't go over very well. So we find nicer ways of saying it. We euphemize everything. Yeah.
We accidentally bombed children.
See, you would not do well in military PR, Preston.
So why don't we dive into some specific words? And I want to begin by, you know, we have a broad audience, I'm sure, listening to this. So I want to begin by just simply unpacking some basic terminology in the conversation, the conversation about faith, sexuality, and gender, or something, you know, as we refer to it, the LGBT plus conversation. And then we'll talk more specifically about words that we maybe should prefer or words we should avoid. I think this is big, especially for conservative Christians who are trying to figure this conversation out. I think it's really important that we learn how to, you know, well, that we learn certain words or unlearn certain words that are, you know, common in our vocabulary that are actually very unhelpful in this conversation. So why don't we begin with the LGBT acronym and maybe even look at the plus sign? Why are we putting this plus sign on there? Or sometimes it's LGBTQ. So why don't I start with a couple of them? You could take the next few and we can just kind of go back and forth. So
fantastic.
LGBT is an acronym standing for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. Now, while a lesbian only applies to females, the term gay can apply to both male, men or women. Now, I think in the past, from my vantage point, it seems that those the lesbian and gay categories were a bit more gender specific, but now I feel like I hear women referring to themselves as lesbian or gay just as almost fluidly as, you know, more fluidly than they maybe did in the past. Hmm. Now, Greg, talk to us about the B and the T, in particular, why the T might be a bit more distant from LGB.
So the B stands for bisexual, which refers to somebody who is oriented towards or experiences attraction towards both men and women. And then the T, transgender, is importantly different from the first three, because whereas the first three are categories of sexual orientation, so here's how I perceive my sexual desire for others. The T, the transgender, has to do with how I perceive my own gender identity. How do I see myself as being male or female?
Now the plus sign, or sometimes the Q that's added on there, you know, you'll see these kind of interchangeably, and you know, depending on where you see it, you'll see maybe various other letters attached to it. Although I feel like the LGBTQ, no more, no less, has become, would you agree that this is probably the most well-known, well-established acronym, the five letters?
I think so. I think either LGBTQ or LGBT plus. Yeah. I see those fairly regularly.
Right. So talk to us about the
Q. But I think either one is safe. I think LGBTQ is maybe the most common. And the right. Q there occasionally has been said to stand for queer or questioning. Most commonly it stands for queer, okay, which is a term that's preferred over gay or lesbian by a number of younger folks who identify as sexual minorities in their orientation. But it has also at times been used as kind of a catch-all term for any sort of sexual orientation or gender variance from the norm. So for instance, in the academy, there's a discipline called queer theory, right, which has to do with that whole spectrum of letters and not just a single spot on a spectrum.
So the Q kind of stands in for several other acronyms, letters that could be tagged onto it. I mean, that becomes pretty impractical when this thing keeps expanding. So Q is kind of like non-straight, cisgender straight.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone uses it that way, but I think that's a common way of using it. And so that's one of the reasons that LGBTQ or LGBT plus both function in pretty similar ways.
Now, when I grew up, I'm 41. When I grew up, queer was a derogatory term. And I think that's why a lot of people my age and up are a little bit shocked that this term queer is now being used. We're like, whoa, can we say that? And maybe I think I always advise straight people to, when in doubt, if you think queer might be offensive, then I would say don't say it unless somebody else is, you know, referring to themselves as that. And it might be offensive for an older straight person to say queer because it has that kind of derogatory background when older straight people have used it. But you're saying that for younger actual gay or sexual minority people, queer is kind of being redeemed. Would that be a good way of describing it?
Yeah. And actually that phenomenon of words that begin as derogatory being taken up by groups and redeemed for common usage happens all over the place in language. The words Christian and Protestant and Quaker, for instance, all began as derogatory. Yankee began as derogatory. So it's not uncommon for groups to take a word and say, actually, we're going to become proud of this term and of the things that it represents. Wow. So that is, I think, what has happened largely with the word queer. But of course, as you said, the safest thing to do is, I think, just to ask people how they prefer to be identified. I think almost everyone I've talked to feels really respected by a question like, can you help me understand what words you're most comfortable with me using? Can you let me know any words that you'd prefer that I not use? Because there are going to be differences, as you said. And so our job is not to try to guess what word somebody's going to prefer. Well, you say you're same-sex oriented and you're over 50, so I'm going to go with gay. we don't necessarily need to have that guessing game. We can try. But in the end, just saying to someone, hey, what do you prefer to call yourself? And then using that language out of respect for them is, I think, a good, safe way to go.
And if you do ask that question, that shows that your heart is wanting to understand. And that, in a sense, gives you – a little bit of breathing room to make some mistakes. I mean, if your spirit is, I really do want to say the right things, I want to respect you, and then you happen to say a word that might be offensive, I think the person's going to be more understanding, saying, oh, they're trying. They're trying to humanize me in this conversation. Now, in the last few minutes, we did use a couple terms we should probably also unpack. One is sexual minority, and the other one, I use it just kind of flippantly, but I said cisgender. So why don't you, what do you mean by sexual minority? And then if you can just unpack quickly what the term cisgender means.
Yeah. So by sexual minority, I mean anybody whose experience of sexual orientation or gender identity is other than the presumed cultural narrative. So if we live in a world where the assumption is that you will be cisgender, which we'll define in a moment, and you will be straight, then to be a sexual minority is to be in any way not part of that dominant group. So whether that's because you're trans, whether it's because you're gay or bi or lesbian, or somewhere else on our spectrum of terms, minority is another catch-all term that some people use. And then cisgender is the opposite of transgender, if you will, or it means, to be more specific, it means that somebody's sense of gender identity accords with our common cultural understanding of what it means to pair gender identity with body's biological sex at birth. So if you come out, I didn't ask you before this if I could say certain naughty words. If you come out with certain male parts looking very male, is that appropriately?
That's fine. That is fine. This is the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender. We're gonna go there.
If you come out looking like you have male parts, and then you feel male growing up, then you're cisgender. You're not experiencing gender dysphoria. There's no reason that you would desire to identify as transgender. Okay, so that's cisgender.
Let me throw out a few more here. I'll take the first couple and I'll throw the last one to you. So transsexual, transgender, and gender dysphoria. Sometimes these three phrases are seen as synonyms, but they are not synonyms. Or in other cases, people don't know what any of these phrases mean. So, and I would love your correction too. I'm gonna give you how I kind of understand these terms and see. I'm gonna let you grade me on how well I'm doing here. So, I understand that transgender refers to somebody whose gender identity is different from their biological sex. Now, I specifically said different, not opposite, because if you say opposite, you assume that male or female are the only two possibilities that somebody could identify with. But in this day and age, whether you agree with it or not, people will identify with many different types of gender. So transgender refers to somebody whose gender identity or experience of gender is different from their biological sex. It's a broad catch-all sort of category. Now, transsexual is typically been used to describe somebody who is pursuing or has pursued some type of either hormone therapy or sex reassignment surgery, one or the other, part of one, part of the other, some sort of actual medical intervention to align their body with their gender identity. Now, the term transsexual is kind of a clinical old word. From my perspective, it feels kind of like homosexual, which we'll get to in a second. So I don't know too many people that would themselves identify as transsexual. They would probably identify as transgender. But technically, those would be like if you're reading a science journal or something, they would use the term transsexual to talk about somebody who has had some surgical intervention, whereas a transgender person may also have had that, but they may not. How does that sound? Is that a good enough distinction?
that's fantastic. If I'm supposed to be grading, we don't give A pluses at Penn State, but we'll call it a solid A. Yeah.
All right. So talk to us about gender dysphoria and how that relates to transgender and transsexual.
Yeah. So gender dysphoria is a term that describes the feeling of a misalignment between one's biological sex as noted at birth and one's internal sense of gender identity. So if you were born with the male parts and yet you feel female, and so you feel like you don't belong in the body that you have, then that creates a sense of discomfort in the mismatch between body and mind, and so that mismatch is called dysphoria. So it's for people who experience it, often a really painful experience that then often leads many, though not all, transgender folks are transgender because of gender dysphoria, but that often is the catalyst for choosing to pursue a gender reassignment surgery or simply for identifying as transgender.
So dysphoria, gender dysphoria, describes specifically the sort of discomfort that many, but not all, transgender people may feel. But the reason why they're not synonyms is because, I mean, I've talked to some transgender people that say, I don't have any dysphoria. My body's male, but I know I'm a woman and I'm perfectly fine with that. Like it's, you know, and that may not be the majority, but you want to make sure that you don't assume every transgender person is a gender dysphoric person.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why don't we dive into gay versus same sex attraction? And I'm going to, I know this one is one you have thought through both on a personal level and on a linguistic level for quite some time. So I'm going to give you a running start and let you finish the race here. So
excellent.
Same-sex attraction, sometimes just listed as SSA, is really a term that conservative Christians have coined. I don't know if they've invented it, but they've kind of coined it. And it's often associated with the so-called ex-gay movement, where some organizations tried to change a gay person's same-sex attraction and make them straight. Now, oftentimes they were told to say, to not say that they're gay, but to say, I simply experience or wrestle with same-sex attraction. So while same-sex attraction can sometimes be perceived as a neutral phrase, it really does have its own possible problems. Now, the term gay, in a sense, in its most basic meaning, just simply means to be attracted to the same sex, to experience a same-sex orientation, or to experience same-gender love as opposed to opposite-gender love, or however you want to frame it. In its most basic sense, same-sex attraction and gay kind of mean the same thing. I think they just have a lot of political baggage wrapped around both terms that often make these two phrases somewhat volatile. So some people that are adamant that you should identify as same-sex attracted and not gay, you know, they would do just that. They would see the term gay as being very unhelpful, and vice versa. People that say, no, you should say gay, not same-sex attraction, they would kind of look at same-sex attraction as this kind of really conservative, almost like ex-gay kind of word. And so there's a lot of tensions here. And I would say, currently, right now, in 2017, there's actually a lot of debates within evangelicalism about these two terms. So, Greg, you wrote a book called Single Gay Christian. So you're on one side of this debate. Can you finish the race for me? Help us understand these two phrases and how we could kind of navigate forward in this conversation.
I think for the sake of this discussion, I'll suggest that there are two basic reasons to pick terminology to describe yourself. One is you pick it because it's helpful for you to think of yourself in that way. Right. So you choose words about yourself because they're helpful for you. And the other is you choose words that are effective at communicating to the people that you want to communicate to. So I think we need to keep both of those questions in mind when we look at why people choose to use the terms that they choose to use. I know a number of Christians who would identify as same-sex attracted who don't prefer the term gay for themselves. And I have great respect for those people. I'm not on a quest to make sure that everyone uses language exactly like I do necessarily. But often what I hear them articulating is that they find the term same-sex attraction helpful for them in their own self-perception. So they have concerns about the way their sexual orientation starts to feel like an all-consuming part of themselves if they use the word gay. So that's the concern that causes them to avoid the term. Personally, I don't have that concern in my own use of the term gay. When I call myself gay, it's not because I spend all my time 24/7 every waking moment thinking about being gay. I don't like make my scrambled eggs and think like, wow, these are some really gay scrambled eggs. Right? Like I just make scrambled eggs like everybody else. And I spend a in my ideal world, I'd like to spend about as much time thinking about being gay as a straight person does about being straight, which is to say it's part of life, but it's not all of life. So for me, because I don't have a concern about using the term gay as it relates to my self-perception, then I turn to that second question, which is how can I choose language that most effectively communicates to the people that I want to communicate to? By and large, what I've found is that if you describe yourself as same-sex attracted, you're going to fit better into the evangelical church, but you're not going to fit terribly well with LGBTQ folks outside the church. Because effectively what you've done linguistically is to say to that group of people, I would prefer not to use the same words as you. I would prefer not to identify with you in that way. My preference has always been to be as missional as possible, even in the ways that I use language. So to the degree that I can speak with other sexual minorities outside the church and say, hey, I'm like you. I want to use language that acknowledges how alike we are. I want to be friends with you and share our experience of life together. I prefer to adopt language that helps that group feel included, that helps them feel brought in. And so if I have to be misunderstood either by the church or by the world, I would prefer to be understood by the world and misunderstood by the church so that the message I can communicate to the world is Jesus loves you, Jesus died for you, and under no circumstances must you become straight in order to love Jesus or to be loved by him.
Wow, that's great. So you're saying when you identify as a gay Christian to the world, that communicates well and it invites them into a gospel sort of discussion. Like, whoa, you can be gay and Christian, and what does that mean? And I could see how that term is actually, yeah, can be, as you said, a more missionally minded term. So in the book, we have this section toward the end of conversation one where we talk about same-sex attraction and gay. We don't get into all the stuff you did there, but one of the things we were really adamant to try to do is to deconstruct the notion that the term gay, or if somebody identifies as gay, that means they are gay affirming, that means they're running around at gay bars, that means they're having tons of gay sex every weekend. Like in the conservative, especially straight conservative world, the term gay is so loaded with all these assumptions. And what we do in the book at the end is to really try to make it really clear that the term gay in of itself simply means somebody is attracted to the same sex and not the opposite sex. It doesn't mean they're acting on it. I mean, in your case, you're committed to singleness because you don't believe that two men can get married and have romantic sexual relations with each other. So the term gay in of itself doesn't have to bring with it all those all the sort of baggage that it sometimes is perceived to have by conservative Christians. In fact, we even make the case that can somebody be gay and be a pastor? Can you go to a church with a gay pastor? And I said, well, if you understand the term correctly, absolutely. Doesn't mean being gay in of itself qualifies you for ministry, but simply being, if you're sexually pure, you're faithful, you're pursuing holiness, repentance, you can do that and still be a gay pastor. I mean, you're a gay worship leader. I mean, that's kind of like,
I am.
You're basically a pastor on some level, right? So, and I know that section might still be really hard for some people, even though it's sort of, hopefully we laid it out clearly and logically enough that people understand what we're saying, but, I would love for you to maybe drive home the nail if it needs to be driven home about the possibility in a conservative evangelical church for there to be a gay elder, gay pastor, gay worship leader. Why is it important that we need to be okay with that term and not ostracize people that simply identify as gay?
Yeah. So if we think about the way a lot of the a lot of the gay rights movement has used the term gay, there's a lot of emphasis on the intrinsic nature of being gay, right? People arguing that they're born gay, or whether or not they were born gay, at least saying, hey, this is all I've known for as long as I've known anything about my sexual orientation, and it seems pretty immutable. It doesn't seem terribly prone to change. I think especially for kids, for young teens who are beginning to have an awareness of their sexual identity, who are finding themselves to be not straight, for a lot of them, the automatic language that they're going to go to is gay. Oh, I'm gay. And if the only narrative that we in the church can offer about gay people is that as soon as you've become gay, you've already rejected God. You're obviously going to have lots of gratuitous sex. You are obviously not going to pay any attention to what the Bible might call you to in terms of sexual purity. If what we do is equate being gay with all of those other things, then what we've done is condemn anyone who begins to perceive themselves as having a sexual same-sex orientation. We've condemned those people to that life. So I think one of the real perks that we have within more conservative churches, if we begin to kind of reclaim the word gay, as it were, and to just use that term to mean same-sex orientation and not to give it all the kind of ethical baggage that comes with it, is that we begin to create more of a possibility for folks in the church who are still trying to figure out what their sexuality means for them. We create a possibility for those folks to continue in faithfulness to Jesus.
That's super helpful, Greg. I appreciate that. That makes tons of sense to me. I hope it does to our listeners. why don't we round the corner here, our final stretch, and let's talk about some terms that are fairly well known among conservative Christians that are actually not very helpful in this conversation, especially when it comes to real people hearing these terms. So some of the ones we talk about in the book, practicing homosexual. What do you have to say about the term practicing homosexual? Have you heard this term? Is this have people referred to you as a practicing homosexual, or has that question been thrown at you? Or help us understand why this just feels kind of goofy to
The LGBTQ community. Sometimes I make fun of that term for the same reason that I make fun of saying that somebody practices law or medicine, which is just that it sounds like you're practicing at something, you're trying to get better at it, as if you wanted to, you know, try to get better at being homosexual. But I think my more serious concern with that term is that it conflates homosexuality with sexual activity. So the word homosexuality, which has this really broad range of meaning and often just means a same-sex orientation, gets conflated with sexual activity if to be a practicing homosexual is to be sexually active in same-sex behavior. So I think there's a danger of assuming that to be homosexual is always to be sexually active, and I think that's part of my concern about that term.
Okay, how about the gay agenda?
the gay agenda, it just makes it sound like we get together and have these big meetings, like all the gay people get together and decide on what the agenda is. and as I often say, I've never been invited to one of those meetings, so. If there is a gay agenda, I've been left out of it. Two problematic things about the term gay agenda. One is that it assumes that we all have the same agenda. So it conflates a group of very diverse people, some of whom are going to be politically liberal or conservative, some of whom are going to be theologically liberal or conservative. And I use the terms liberal and conservative here in big air quotation marks. So it takes a whole bunch of people and it tries to cram their experience down into a single model. Here's what it means to be gay. In all cases, they all have the same agenda. My other concern with the term is that some of what does fall under what's often called the gay agenda, which is to say concerns that a lot of gay people have in common. Some of those things are things that I think even the most conservative evangelical communities ought to be able to get behind. So for instance, what we might call the gay agenda is wanting to diminish bullying in schools. They're hoping to diminish teen suicide rates among LGBTQ youth. And those are things that I really, really hope, regardless of our theological stances, that conservative evangelicals can get behind. And so I think the danger of dismissing those concerns as being part of some fictional gay agenda is that it causes us to miss out on the possibility for really important common ground with folks who are not like us.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, yeah, that's super helpful to think through, that there are certain things, like in any movement, that there are going to be some helpful things, things that we can learn from. I've often said that even other religions, like there are things about other religions, you know, that I think can be really helpful, that can be challenging to us, and things that we should sort of imitate, even while saying that the religion as a whole is not Christian, is headed the wrong way, is, you know, leading people away from God. But I mean, I think of Muslims have a very high view of God, very,
yeah.
In some ways a healthy fear, in some ways, and a really high view of God. I'm like, well, man, my Calvinist Reformed brothers and sisters say the same thing. And I amen that God is utterly sovereign. He's creator overall. The dedication of some Muslims, you know, or Jewish people, or even, you know, LDS, people, the LDS faith.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Their dedication is just astounding. And I think it's okay to say, you know what, this system or belief or ideology as a whole may be wrongheaded, maybe not Christian at all, but there are certain things in it that we can applaud, which is hard to do when you broad brush the entire thing.
Yeah.
You know, the gay lifestyle, I guess, is kind of the same as practicing homosexual. It kind of reduces somebody's entire gay existence to whether or not they're actively having sex or not. This one I feel like is a little more subtle, but just the term homosexual, and we talk about this in the book, but I would love to hear from you, like, what is it about the term homosexual that, even though, again, on paper it's just a term that means attracted to the same sex, but the way it's been used isn't always the most helpful.
Yeah, the term homosexual is, in part, it's just an old word in the conversation. So I've sometimes compared it to a floppy disk, in that you could still talk about floppy disks if you wanted, but if someone enters a conversation about technology and brings up floppy disks, that will be a cue to the rest of us that this person has maybe not kept up very well on the conversation about technology. And I think, right, similarly, if people are using the word homosexual and thinking that that's a term that a lot of people like to identify as in its noun sense, the homosexuals, then that's probably a person who's not very informed in the conversation. That term also does have a history of being used by Christians precisely because they're aware that it's not preferred by LGBTQ folks. So for instance, there was a Christian web app for a while. I don't know if it still exists, but it could read any web page and replace any use of the word gay with the word homosexual.
Really?
Just so that the conversation could be tweaked in such a way that it wasn't the way LGBTQ folks wanted to talk about themselves. And so there was a group of Christians who used that term almost as a weapon of sorts, precisely because they knew it wasn't the preferred term. So between those two things, that it has a history of being used as intentionally derogatory, and that it's just a very old word in the conversation, I think it's worth avoiding, again, as a noun, as a designator of people. I don't think it's helpful.
Well, that's thanks for that. That totally makes sense. One more term, and then we can kind of, you know, there's many other terms we could talk about, but these are kind of some of the big ones. And one, well, because the transgender conversation is becoming so popular now, one phrase that I feel like is being used a lot by straight cisgender Christians is the term gender confused, or even if that's not coined yet, but just they'll talk about people confused about their gender, or even, you know, men pretending to be women. I just find the transgender people that I know, that just, it shows that you haven't actually sat down and listened to the experience of a transgender person. Using the term confused is just, you know, it just shows that you haven't actually, tried to understand what a person's actually going through. You know, that one of my transgender friends says, again, whether you agree with it or not, he would say, I'm not confused at all. I know I'm a woman.
Sure.
And I don't actually agree with that. I think that God made him a man, and I would, you know, and I've had that conversation with him in love and respect. But if I say, no, you are confused, that just isn't helpful relationally. you know, I can say, you know what, I've got a different sort of view on how biology interacts with gender, and we can talk about that. I want to learn from him, and he actually learns from me. But the term gender confused just puts a relational wall up, you know, and shows you're not really trying to listen. So, Greg, any other terms, thoughts you have on language as we're about to end here?
I'm all out of thoughts. No, I think that's it's a good place to leave the conversation. I guess I'll just kind of leave with a restatement of something that I said earlier, which was that if you're listening to this and feeling kind of overwhelmed by the preponderance of terms and like there's 1800 ways to do it wrong and I'm bound to offend somebody as soon as I open my mouth, I think the best thing you can do is interact with folks with a posture of humility and tell them, hey, how can I use language that honors you? How can I love you well in this conversation? And I think the heart behind that is such that the vast majority of folks are going to receive you well, are going to be loved by that. So I don't think anyone needs to enter this conversation feeling like they're getting into an impossible guessing game of terminology. But it's helpful to be as aware as possible and to do as much learning beforehand as you can so that you can avoid offense wherever possible. But I think ultimately it's the heart of the matter as expressed right through your words that matters most.
Well, that's a great word to end on, that this is we should be focused on the heart, a heart of humility. We will make mistakes in the words we use, in how we relate to people. But if our heart is truly gospel-centered, Jesus-centered, others-centered, wanting to humanize other people, then I think we're in good shape there. So I hope that this episode will help further the knowledge that you walked away with after reading Conversation 1 of the Grace Truth book. If you are not familiar with the Grace Truth book, if you're getting this podcast from outside of that study, then you can check out the Grace Truth 1.0 small group learning experience at centerforfaith.com, along with many other resources, other podcasts, blogs, pastoral papers, speaking events. Please check out our event page at centerforfaith.com, and we will see you next time on the Grace Truth podcast.